This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news today with Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning.
Dan Haar, editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media. Hello there, Danny.
Good morning. Great to be here.
And Susan Raff, WFSB politics reporter, making her debut on The Wheelhouse. Hi there, Susan.
Woohoo. Good morning, everybody.
And if you want to join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. We weren't here last week. We'd hoped to talk to Susan Raff about the GOP debate that she covered. So maybe we'll start there. We'll start with the Republicans who are seeking the governor's office. There's been a little bit of movement on the Democratic side this week. But why don't we start with you, Susan? What did you learn from that group of Republican contenders who were facing off?
Well, I think I learned a lot of people want to be governor. I don't understand exactly why, especially with the state in such a financial distress. But, I mean, you have 9 different candidates, and it seemed like they were all kind of jockeying in position, trying to distinguish themselves. I'm not sure if that really came off that way, but they did. I think that was, you know, they're that. And they made a big issue, I think, of being a career politician. Those who aren't in politics, you know, took some jabs at those who are for selectmen and mayor, and there are a lot of them.
So are there any policy distinctions being made here? I mean, we've talked about this in the show before. It's easy for Republicans to say, we don't want the income tax anymore, which doesn't seem like a terribly realistic thing. But, I mean, what were you hearing from the policy side of things?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I know Mayor Boughton from Danbury has talked about that. He wants to get rid of the income tax. He hasn't quite said how he's going to do that. And I think we're all kind of like jaws are open going, how can you do that at this time? You know, the tolls, things like that. I mean, the state really needs money. And, you know, people kind of teeter on that. I thought the candidates didn't really take a stand one way or another. Just they may not. They want to look at all of these things, but decisions are going to have to be made.
We want to look at all the options, Danny.
They are looking at all the options. There are 2 ways to look at this field of Republicans. There are including the 9 that were there and the 2 self-funded candidates who are so busy self-funding that they didn't show up. That's Stemmerman and Stefanowski. Actually, Stefanowski may not be self-funded. He's raised a lot of money. In any case, there are 2 ways to look at this field. One is that it's you know, whatever animated film characters that Colin wants to come up with, and we're trusting that you will. And the other is that they're actually pretty good. And the latter scenario is bad for the Republican Party. Because as I wrote and Chris Healy has been writing, and a lot of people are saying, there is no easy way to winnow this field because the money is divided so evenly. Boughton, who is, I guess you could say, would you say he's the front runner?
I would say the Boughton.
I would say so, and he knows how to manipulate his time, certainly at the end.
Correct me if I'm wrong. He still hasn't qualified for public financing.
Right? No,
he will.
Not.
But the fact is that it's January and the front runner has still not qualified. That means he's still running around, you know, looking for money, and that means that he looks a lot like everybody else.
To be fair, he did have brain surgery.
Okay.
That'll slow you down a little bit.
I'll give you that. But all right, okay. So let's give him this quarter. But the bottom line is that even if you allow for that, the field, there are 7.
He's not even the candidate in the Republican field, I think, needs brain surgery, but he did have brain surgery.
There are 7 people in the field who already have $200,000 either toward the goal or toward self-funding. And that's not and as you say, it's very difficult to tell policy positions apart. Yes, there's the income tax crowd versus the Dave Walkers who say, you people are nuts. You're not going to do away with the income tax. And there are the people who want to chip away at spending, the Loretti's and the Herbsters who say, the problem we have is spending. Well, the problem isn't spending, but they want to keep saying that because they're boxed in because they don't have an easy, big way to change things without raising taxes.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, this whole question of winnowing the field is, I think, an unusually difficult one this time around. I don't remember a cycle quite like this one. I mean, really, if you add them all up, there's somewhere around 25 candidates on if you add up both sides. And that's a lot. You know, it's going to be hard. The Citizens Election Program contributes to this a little bit because if you can qualify for the CEP, you know, you really have a kind of viability going into the primary season. But, you know, the if nothing else winnows them before the convention will be the great threshing mechanism. They have to get 15% or more in order to qualify for the primary or go the signature route. So, I mean, when they hit that point, first of all, there'll be some deal making on both sides. Some people are going to drop down to other parts of the ticket and throw their support to some of the more leading candidates. But particularly, like, I could maybe name you can't wait to start talking about this. Yeah. But I could probably name on the Democratic side the four that I think would go into the convention in a position to maybe pull from other people.
And one of them is neither self-funded nor a CEP candidate.
What is this, a riddle?
I thought what was interesting about the field of candidates was that Senator Toni Bouchet, she hasn't officially declared. Mm. She also has not reached the financial threshold. But they felt that they wanted her to be part of the debate. So I wonder if, you know, on the Democrat side where you have Susan Bicewitz and, you know, they see this attraction to women, that maybe the Republican Party would like Toni Bouchet to be part of this dynamic.
The Democrats have Susan Bicewitz and Dita Bhargava. I mean, I don't know if I'm missing anybody else. But
no, Toni Bouchet, right. Interesting. Well, they didn't want to have a stage full of white men in gray suits. No blue suits this time.
Although that has never bothered them in the past.
That's right. That, I guess it hasn't. But it didn't. It doesn't play in 2018, presumably. But she only raised so far $71,000. She, interestingly, is presenting herself as the only candidate who can win, presumably being a centrist. But then when you ask her for ideas, they're not centrist ideas.
And the threshold for the second debate is much higher, isn't it? It's like 250,000, or they have to have that level. So if she hasn't reached the first,
the threshold is what J.R. Romano says.
You've actually provided me with a little bit of a segue here, because before we talk about the Democratic field, Colin, let's just talk a little bit about this Republican Party. I think Susan just raises a good point. Does this party want to have a stage full of kind of middle-aged white dudes in gray suits, or do they want to show that they have a little bit of diversity? Meanwhile, you have the head of the Republican Party who's now embroiled in yet another little controversy around another character who doesn't wear gray suits but seems to wear head-to-toe American flag apparel everywhere he goes. And this is in contrast to the former head of the GOP, Chris Healy, who we've mentioned already, who's sounding a bit more sage, saying maybe we need to thin the herd and maybe we need to act a little bit more as an adult party. I don't know where we want to place with this J.R. Romano situation right now.
Okay, so J.R. Romano is the Republican state chair. He's on the young side for that job. One of the things that he has shown a fondness for, as you are alluding to, is hanging out with a group of people who do these little videos called Whiskey Patriots. It's usually four guys, although the cast rotates a little bit. But one of them was Carl Higbee, and Carl Higbee recently was forced out of a very fairly prominent job at the Trump administration because radio interviews or sort of web radio interviews surfaced with him saying really, I mean, kind of shockingly racist stuff, particularly about blacks, although also about Muslims. But, you know, like really, really, you know, hold your nose kind of stuff. And, you know, this is sort of a recurring problem with J.R. Romano is that on the one hand, he's, you know, supposedly running the whole Republican Party, but he shows kind of a fondness for these kind of Trumpy associations. And that's a party problem for the whole party in general in Connecticut. In other words, to what degree is this the party of Trump? And to what degree is this a party of Republicans who see another way and want to go another way? And you know, one of the I think today you see maybe the first tangible casualty of this question in that Mark Pastaniokas has a report about the fact that Andre Baumgartner, who was a young Republican, I think elected to the House at the age of 20, he's now 23, he's dropped out of the party. He's dropped out of the House. He's the treasurer for the Democratic campaign of the legislator he unseated in the first place. And he's very open about the fact that he just is not comfortable with the vibe of the Republican Party right now. The name J.R. Romano was not mentioned, but if I were Andre Baumgartner and I was aware of the fact that my state chairman was participating in these bro videos, you know, with that included Carl Higbee, I'd be super uncomfortable with that.
And I'll say the only video that is still sort of left out of that suite of videos is one in which Higbee says terrible things about transgender people, which clearly weren't as bad as the terrible things that he said about black people or anybody else.
You're alluding to the fact, just to be clear, they had to scrub a lot of these videos. They did scrub a lot of these videos off the web, so you can't see JR and Carl together so much.
I wouldn't disagree that he can be brash, and I think that, you know, part of his appeal may be unpalatable for some. However, I would say that I give him a lot of credit for what he's doing with the debates. I mean, he's brought these candidates together. The Democrats seem to be upset about that. They were almost annoyed that they were getting the kind of coverage that they would. I mean, at least he's putting these candidates out there and let the voters see, like, what they're about and what they stand for.
But how much do those candidates then have to answer for the fact that J.R. Romano and many other people in the party seem to be supporting Trump? Danny's shaking his head.
I'm shaking my head. They do not have to answer about J.R. Romano. And I'll step in here as the House conservative, as usual, right? And defend J.R. Romano.
Hold on. When did you come as the House conservative?
What did Chuck Schumer say about negotiating with Jell-O? That's like trying to figure out what Danny is thinking
right,
on any given day.
But J.R. Romano, I see J.R. Romano as a sincere sort who represents a constituency that is not the Weicker Lodge Republican tradition. He's the second district Republicans who are more rural, more Trump-like. And because he comes from that wing of the party and speaks of that wing of the party doesn't necessarily mean that he has the same thoughts in his head as the Higbys and the Bannons of the world. Furthermore, the big issue is that these Republicans are going to have to answer to Trump. J.R. Romano is not going to be a factor in the election. Donald Trump is. And Donald Trump is going to be a much bigger factor than Dan Malloy. And that's their problem in respect to association.
And how big do you think the Trump factor is here in Connecticut?
Gargantuan. You can't overstate it. I think it's enormous. And as we see with this Baumgarten, absolutely, no question.
I mean, I do think, first of all, it doesn't matter who the state chairman of either party is. Most people can't name that person. That person's function is lower and less important than it was decades ago. So at that level, it doesn't really mean anything. But, you know, back to the point that Susan and Danny were making at the beginning that, you know, they have Tony Boucher up there, so it's not all white dudes. Well, ultimately, if you want to grow, you have to acknowledge demographics. This country is changing. This state is changing. Republicans have always been chronically underregistered to this state. They have a huge registration disadvantage. It's why, despite the fact that, you know, there's discontent with the legislature, discontent with the governor, generically the Democrats are still running ahead of Republicans. One reason for that is Trump. Another reason is the Republicans don't put themselves in a very good position to expand. They now have one Republican legislator left, who is black. So, I mean, you don't put yourself in a good position to expand if you don't have some intelligible way of talking to some of the people that you don't have yet.
Let me turn to the Democratic side, because since last we joined you, we had one person get into the race, Ned Lamont, one person get out of the race, Dan Drew. I don't know, where do we want to start, Danny, with that? We've got Ned Lamont deciding to get in. You want to start there? Or you want to start with Dan?
Yes. No. Let's start. Didn't we do away with Dan already? I don't.
No.
Dan
no.
Drew.
Yeah.
He's yeah. That.
No,
yes.
But I mean, all of us as a collective speakership here have sort of eliminated Dan Drew from our thoughts by now, haven't we?
Well, no, actually, the last wheelhouse that we had, because we missed a week because of the storm, we actually had a call or a tweet or something from somebody who said we were ignoring Dan Drew and how important he was.
Well,
and
he's important. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, let's talk with Ned Lamont. Ned Lamont represents the Democratic Party in a very interesting way, and that is that he's you want to like him. He's compelling. And he's got a great narrative. And by the way, many of these Republicans are stronger than you might think when you look at you know, who they are. When you go and listen to them, they're pretty good, actually. And that could be a problem for them, that they're all pretty good. Ned Lamont has that issue. And then you want to say, okay, great, what's your idea? Right? And he hasn't exactly precisely said what his idea is, other than that he's going to take care of people and he's going to invest. Right? So we know that the Democrats want to continue to invest in the state, which, by the way, is a really good idea, because the housing decline that we've had in Connecticut as compared to the 6% increase in Massachusetts, and I did watch Charlie Baker's speech last night, and boy, are they celebrating up there. Eventually, it reaches equilibrium, and it only benefits Connecticut if we've kept the state up. We can't let the state go down the tubes in spending and infrastructure and all that. That's the message that the Democrats bring. The problem is money, and they don't have an answer.
I think Ned Lamont has a few messages. I had the opportunity to speak with him last week when he decided to make it official. I actually covered him in 2006 for Senate and then for governor. He is really trying to reach out to women. He's the $15 an hour minimum wage. I think he might be kind of like a Bernie Sanders kind of appeal. And I think he will get a lot of young people who will find him very attractive. The one thing that he's trying to say is, you know, he's an outsider, but I'm not so sure that people will agree with that. You know, he's also a Greenwich millionaire, a white man in a suit. As Colin points out.
He's in sweaters in this campaign.
Okay.
The one thing I will say that I took away from his initial video, the one policy point that he made clear is, yeah, he'd like to get the state to a $15 minimum wage, which I think resonates with an awful lot of people. It resonates with a lot of people on the left. I will say, Colin, if indeed there is an attempt to appeal to some of the independent voters, maybe some of the people in some of the outlying areas, I'll tell you, I talk to a lot of small business people who say that $15 an hour minimum wage is kind of a non-starter for them, and that's not necessarily the lead card they'd like to see played by the Democratic candidate.
Right. Susan's making an interesting point, although I would just say in terms of optics, Ned Lamont is Bernie Sanders the way I'm like Katy Perry, which is to say not at all, really. I don't know.
Can you sing?
I wouldn't, you know.
They're both human.
Right. They're both human. That's about it. I don't know. I couldn't tell you how well the $15 minimum wage is going to play, particularly with the general electorate. We sort of have to back up and say, why are these people looking for issues? Well, you know, they're not. And I think this is sort of part of what Danny is saying, too, is they're not looking for a lot of issues right now. All they're trying to do is go to the convention without alienating any particular group of people and while sewing up some other group of people. So that group of kind of progressive Democrats, the Bernie Democrats, to Susan's point, is probably available to somebody. I don't think there's a really clearly marked out person who gets that, who automatically get it. Drew was really going after it before he went toes up. And Ned will probably try to go after it now. Now, whether a one percenter from Greenwich, you know, who belongs to country clubs and stuff like that, can be as persuasively progressive as Bernie Sanders, I think is an open question. I would expect Bicewicz also to try to stake that thing out. People perceive Susan Bicewicz as a progressive. I'm never 100% sure I understand why that is. I think the one policy vector that I can identify will be Luke Bronin, who I think will run way towards the center. I think Luke Bronin is going to run as a guy who stood up to municipal employee unions in Hartford and can do kind of the same thing as a Democratic candidate. I think he's going to go after the opposite wing of the party. I don't really know who emerges as the Bernie Sanders of this race.
I'm glad we finally got unions in there, because that's exactly what I was thinking about Bronin. The union issue is going to be enormous in this campaign on both sides. The Republicans have stopped hiding the fact that they want to break CBAC. They're even some of the centrist people like Dave Walker are talking openly and saying, we have to break this deal. And of course, there's no legal way to do that until 2027, and they sort of know that. On the Democratic side, the candidate who is perceived rightly or wrongly as being in the pocket of unions is going to lose.
Mm. Susan?
I just wanted to add a couple things, because Dan had mentioned, you know, the whole self-funded thing. And I think that's a double-edged sword. I think some people see that as attractive, that you're not beholden to anyone. I think Ned Lamont has certainly highlighted that. But, you know, then you have to look at somebody who has so much money that they can afford to buy their way into anything. As for Luke Bronin, you know, I think that his biggest downfall is that people are going to say, you committed to 4 years. You were going to stay in the city. And he's leaving the city at a very, very important time where they're really trying to have this oversight board and financial stability. So I think that's going to hurt him. Agree or not?
No, I totally. He's got a huge problem with that. And I don't want to overstate his chances. But right now, I think all anybody's playing for on either side is 15% plus the safety margin of the convention vote. I mean, there's this sort of a game theory thing that goes on here, because the other thing you could do is go to the convention and try to get 25, and then you'll mathematically probably crowd out somebody you would have had to run against in the primary. But mostly because they're so fragmented and there's so many of them, they're just going to try to nail down 15%. So Luke's already got some Waterbury votes. He's got a Neil O'Leary tie. If he's got Hartford's votes and Waterbury's votes, you know, he's almost halfway there probably. So that's what they're playing for right now. And then they'll figure it out, you know, message-wise. They'll be launching their ads from May to August.
What about the Malloy factor? Do you think that his close alignment with the governor will help or hurt him?
Well, if they can make it an issue, it'll hurt him. I mean, it's not going to be any good. But I don't think – I think that's something that we know about and think about. I don't know that the average voter will process
it. Yeah, go ahead.
I think we should tell the listeners that the entire script for this conversation was, in fact, written by Oz Griebel, the independent candidate for governor.
Not literally.
not literally.
But what do you mean by that?
Yeah, say more, Dan.
We're describing a scenario on both sides where there's essentially no way for either side to define itself clearly and to winnow its field to a winnable candidate.
Yes.
And that's the only scenario that Oz Griebel – he can't raise money. He can't raise enough money to compete. He has to go on message. And the only message that's going to propel him to a respectable and possibly winning showing is – two sides being unable to define themselves.
Okay, we got to take a break there. Dan Haar is editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media. Susan Raff covers politics for WFSB, Channel 3. And Colin McEnroe is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. When we come back, we're going to talk about transportation projects. A lot of them at the state level got stalled, but that's okay. There's a big infrastructure plan coming from the Trump administration. Oh, wait, that's right. More after this on The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We are talking about the week's news with Susan Raff, who covers politics for WFSB, Dan Haar, who's an editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media, and our own Colin McEnroe. Colin, what is on your show today?
Today, our show is about the aesthetic known as noir. We see it in films. We see it in novels. We see it on television. We even see like science fiction versions of noir, like Bright on Netflix. So we'll talk about what that's all about and what the big appeal is. I'd also like to point out our long-awaited, by us, not by you, constipation show is going to be on Thursday. The constipation show got stuck in the pipeline, literally, and we're excited about it now.
This is why you contribute to public radio.
Right.
The constipation show coming up tomorrow on the Colin McEnroe Show, noir later on today. Speaking of things that are stalled, Dan Malloy has put on hold a series of transportation projects, big transportation projects that were part of his plan for some years. He's doing it because, well, there's not money in the Special Transportation Fund to actually pay for these things. We'll get to whether or not there's any money coming from the federal government to pay for any of these things in the moment. But I don't know, Colin, just to start with you, this has been a big part of Malloy's promises to the state that we're going to fix some of the massive transportation projects we have. But he's been saying for quite a long time that unless we actually commit to funding transportation the right way, it's going to be hard to fix the roads and bridges, to fix the trains and everything else that we need to get people around.
Right. So, and by the way, this is happening at the federal level. The Federal Highway Fund is every bit as shaky as our transportation lockbox. This is a high expense area of government involvement, not as high as having an enormous defense budget, but it's still a high expense thing. I think there is no easy answer to this. You have a badly deteriorating transportation infrastructure, and there's stuff that's got to get fixed, or there will be a tragedy. I mean, we lived through a period where really bad things happened, especially the Mayanus River bridge collapse. Nobody wants to go through that again. Some of this stuff has really got to be addressed. It's sort of no fooling. After you get past that point, I think there's a different kind of conversation that has to come in. And although I'm not somebody who spends my life dumping on Dan Malloy, I thought in 2015 when he rolled out that 30-year, $100 billion package, it didn't prioritize well. You know, if you have 20 policies, you have no policy. And ultimately, in a transportation plan, you have to pick winners and losers. You have to say, look, this is how we see the future. And so we're going to build this part of the future, and we're going to try to phase out this part of the past. And I don't think it ever did that very well. So I mean, until we get some money, it doesn't matter. And I guess we're about to talk about tolls and stuff like that. But ultimately, it'll be unaffordable unless they can sort of narrow down the idea of what it actually is.
A concrete example of that, Dan, that we've talked about quite a bit is that if you say we're going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars widening the highways, which will have the effect of putting more people on the highways, you can't also say we want to drive more people onto trains and public transportation. Those two things are actually at cross purposes.
Yes, they are. I was one of those people who used to say that if you widen highways, that just brings in more traffic. That's the general left-leaning view of widening
it's
highways.
It's not left-leaning view. It's actually a peer-reviewed study view that's been, I think, pretty
validated
well backed
over
up
over, again,
over,
yeah.
the, over the years
yes.
in places like Minnesota and other places
yes.
where they've done this and they've really looked at this.
The peer-reviewed study by U.S. PERG, but it's still a peer-reviewed study. In any case, we agree. but now that I work down there, I have a slightly different view of widening highways.
Down in Fairfield County.
Down in Fairfield County, right. It is a crisis down there. And so the two things that you need to do are, one, tolls, and more tolls. You got to have it. It's crazy. It's giving away money not to have tolls. And the other, it's going to obviously congestion pricing. And you do have to do some work on the stretch of 95 along
but,
near
but just
Norwalk.
To clean up my argument, just to be clear, is you can't say widen the highways and also no tolls, right? You can't say we're going to do this in order to relieve congestion through this terribly congested corridor and not also toll it in order to recoup the cost necessary to pay for all those people, especially the people who are on trucks and big old transports
yes.
that aren't even residing in the state.
And or the gas tax. It's notable that the business groups right now are calling for a gas tax.
Right. And AAA came out with an interesting study yesterday, 47% of people support tolls. Now, that's barely half. However, when you look at the gas tax, which was, I think, 16%, and the mileage tax, which was some, I don't know, idea that was passed and went away as quickly as it was proposed. So I think more people are coming around to it. But I do think that there's a distinction between, like, the northern part of the state and Fairfield County. Most people in Fairfield County do not support tolls, and I think it's because of their proximity to New York. I think people spend a lot of money in that part of the state on that. However, I agree with you. I think, you know, when you talk about like political candidates, Senator Boucher always, you know, when I think of anti-tolls, I see her, you know, waving her stick around. But the fact is, most people that I come in contact with say, I think we should have them. What are you going to do, raise the gas tax?
Yes, the answer to the gas tax. First of all, tolls are 2 to 3 years away. Jim Redeker is trying really hard to say that we think we can do it in 3 years. So a 4 cent a gallon gas tax is going to be this year's sales tax debate, which was last year, you call. We really needed to have a sales tax to balance the budget. We couldn't balance the budget without a sales tax increase. We didn't, and as a result, we don't have a balanced budget.
Gas tax
this year.
But looking forward, balancing budgets on the back of a gas tax when you have more fuel-efficient cars, Colin, when you
right.
have the possibility of not actually recouping the money that you hope to recoup because people are using cars less and using more fuel-efficient cars, is the gas tax a way to go?
Well, look at what we just did here anyway, and I totally blame Danny for this, which is we were talking about how we're going to fund transportation. Now we're talking about how we're going to balance the budget with our gas tax.
Lockbox.
Which is exactly what the legislature is going to do. That's what they do every single time. And we just did it, too. We've become enablers or codependent or something like that, you know, which is we veered away from actually dedicating money to solving some of these problems, which need to be solved. And we're just talking about it as a way of balancing the budget. Well, no. I mean, ultimately, you are going to have to identify certain kinds of revenue that and it goes back to what Dan was saying at the beginning, too, which is it's good public policy to make people who use something heavily, a lot more heavily than most people do, pay for a larger part of that cost of that.
And Dan is right about the lockbox. I think that every single study that they've done when they've asked people, people are very strong about that. They do not want to see any money, whether it's a gas tax, whether it's tolls, go to anything else. And lawmakers have been against that because they don't like to be told that they can't spend that money. But I think if anything is going to pass, it's going to have a lockbox, which is you're aware that they're voting in November on the ballot to decide that because the governor wanted that in place first.
The governor's wanted it for some time, Dan, but I mean, I don't know. The reality of an actual lockbox that allows us to pay into it for transportation projects over the course of time so that we can continue to maintain the roadways and also build new transportation infrastructure. It just seems like yet another thing that somehow or other the legislature will come and raid.
The lockbox is like the spending cap. You know, you can have it in place, but unless it's constitutional, it doesn't exist. And I think that's fine because the legislature shouldn't have its hands tied. You have priorities and you have to live and die by those priorities. The bottom line is that until the state turns around economically, we're not going to be able to build a $3.5 billion viaduct in Hartford and an $8 billion mixmaster in Waterbury. Those projects that the governor canceled, we didn't have that money the day before he canceled them. Everybody knew they were going to be canceled. Jim Redeker has been talking about the cancellation of those things for months now, that we don't have the money. And so if you don't have the money, when the governor steps up 6 months later and says, oh, gee whiz, they're canceled, we shouldn't be all of a sudden shocked.
So there are $4 billion in projects that are now on hold because of the state's transportation fund and the problem. So here's the question. If it's going to take 3 to 5 years to put tolls in, what do you do in the meantime?
Well, you do a gas tax, and then they steal it.
You do a gas take tax, my bicycle.
You do a gas tax with a lockbox,
yeah,
and you actually fund this for a while. No, I hinted at this too. I mean, maybe we can rely on the federal government coming forward. I mean, Donald Trump comes into office, Colin, he says, you know, we spent these trillions of dollars on overseas wars. What if we spend that money more at home? We put it into our infrastructure, and now we find that the Trump administration does have a plan. They've hinted that it would lean heavily on new spending by states, local governments. But now there's a leaked outline of that plan. It seems to confirm things. We're reading this in Governing Magazine that the federal government would take a backseat in funding its own infrastructure initiatives. So the states like Connecticut, which are broke, are now going to have to pay for it.
Right. So before I get to that, let me just back up and honor the spectral presence of Keith Vanoff, who I think if he were here would say that the other way in which we're sort of caught in a weird cycle here, at least he said this in the past, is if your strategy for luring business to the state is tax abatement, is fancy tax packages, you end up with a lot of businesses and not enough money to do any of the things that you need to do to create infrastructure that the businesses need, that there's a little bit of a self-harming cycle there too. It's one of the reasons that a lot of things that get initially approved by the Bond Commission can't get greenlighted for real. Anyway, sort of to go on to this other thing, yes, anybody who thought that the federal government, particularly in the federal government in the form of the Donald Trump administration, was going to come riding over the hill with white hats to save particularly infrastructure in blue states. You know, I've got a bridge. I got a couple of bridges in Connecticut. I'd be interested in selling them. I didn't think that was particularly likely to begin with. And I think also this is one of the things we know about the Trump administration is after a year, they still haven't figured out whether they're the group of people who ran a certain kind of campaign with a certain kind of rhetoric in 2016 or whether they've deserted those positions and staked out new ones. I mean, Schumer is right. It is trying to negotiate with Jell-O because you don't even really know whether you're dealing with kind of a Rockefeller Republican or some kind of far right Steve Bannon-y kind of guy. And I think this is just another indication of that.
To be fair, he does wear a white hat when he's working in the Oval Office. I saw pictures just this week. Danny, I know you wanted to jump in.
Not one shard of paper on that desk. Anyone seen? He should work in a newspaper office. We'll see what it looks like.
Susan?
I wanted to touch on the federal commitment. Congresswoman Esty was in town, I think, a couple of weeks ago, and with a nice proposal of what they want to do in Washington to try to get the government to fund more projects. But in the end, I didn't get a good sense that, this was just that this is a wish list and there was no commitment. So if there is no money from the federal government really coming in or very little, or how does the state, manage that?
We're back to the same problem. But I read the 6-page leaked memo, and it's 20% maximum federal contribution for regular projects, 30% for transformational projects. And the high one on the list there is, of course, Larson's Tunnel through underneath Hartford to redo 84 and 91. But I did not read a stated limit for the rural projects, which is a big percent, 25% of the whole piece. No stated federal limit. So there again, we see the red states favored, as Colin said. I don't see an answer to this, but I and furthermore, even worse than that is over and above the infrastructure, special infrastructure funding, the regular federal highway funding collapses in 2020 by $8 billion.
Because as we all know, fixing roads in places where people don't live as much is really going to help solve our problems. But anyway, quickly, let's go to Bill. Bill's calling from Farmington, I think. What's on your mind, Bill?
Hi. The toll thing is sort of dangerous when I hear the thing about Fairfield County. First of all, the idea of the pricing what is it called? Demand pricing.
Congestion pricing, yeah.
It only works when you have an alternative. There's no alternative. So what happens when you put a toll on 95, you drive all the congestion onto the local roads, you bring commerce down, you lower everything. If you talk, I talked once to the chief, the fire chief guy from Fairfield from Fairfield. He said they know how much it costs to have a wreck in commerce in Fairfield. Like, they have numbers on that. If you put tolls on 95, you cause a big mess. And you know they'll put it all the way to the Rhode Island border, which means even people out to the east are going to be paying tolls, which means they're not. They're going to go on Route 1. Route 1 will be backed up. It's just a mess. It's not like going through New Jersey where you can say, I'll take Route 287 to 78 to you know, you go the back way and get to Philadelphia and save $30 in tolls.
Yeah,
you know, instead of the turnpike, there is no alternative in Connecticut.
Hey, Bill, thank you very much for the phone call. And let me go to Susan first, but I want to hear Danny's take on this too, especially being located in Fairfield County. Now, go ahead.
Well, I think you raised some good points, and that is, you know, Connecticut is a small state, and you know, I think part of the, you know, the solution, you can't just put tolls at the borders. You have to have them in other places, and I think that's why it's going to take years of thoughtful planning. But I agree in a state.
Which we're great at here in Connecticut. Yeah. We're fantastic at that.
But I think it is a challenge because it is not a state that has a huge infrastructure in place where you can strategically put tolls. So I think that's an issue.
So, I mean, to Bill's point, Dan, this is something we've heard for years. If you push traffic onto the post road, it causes congestion problems, it causes all sorts of problems. And that really is a Fairfield County, Southern Connecticut problem that isn't easily replicated anywhere else in the state.
In that sense, Fairfield County is like California. There are no back roads. There are only the two main roads, and it's a problem. By the way, I'm with the caller. Is it Bill? On New Jersey, it's actually faster to go 287 to, I think, 206 or 208 to Philadelphia. Not only cheaper.
Being from New Jersey. One of those Saturday Night Live skits.
There you go. But it is true. There are not back roads in Fairfield. Maybe what happens is people pay more money and drive more intelligently. Instead of making three trips, you make two. I don't know that that makes sense.
Well, first of all, let's back up here. There are alternatives. First of all, Metro North isn't running great, but you can get on Metro North and go a lot of the places that you need to go on 95. Let's start there. That's alternative number one. And what you really want to do, ultimately, back to our early point, is push people off of 95 and onto trains. Trains probably have to be a little bit better than they are right now. That's number one. Number two, I'm not convinced that particularly what will happen is municipalities will make those roads less attractive once they realize they got a problem. There's lots of ways that they can do that. And I'm also not convinced that human behavior works the way that Bill is saying that it works, because the truth is, if you want to drive up to Maine right now, you're going to have to go through New Hampshire. They're going to make you pay a toll. You're barely going to know it's happening. You're going to drive under, you know, some kind of, you know, metallic structure overhead. You know, people are going to have the transponders on their cars. They're not going to feel the pain that much. They'll work it into the budget that they have if they use these tolls regularly. I'm just not convinced that there's a lot of people who are going to want to sit in a traffic jam in Milford, you know, so that they can beat their way out of some toll. If you do this program, you do have to factor for people whose financial resources really, you know, can't meet this challenge. There's got to be some kind of sliding scale. There's got to be some kind of low income relief. But other than that,
Better public transportation to get people who need public transportation
Absolutely.
There. Quickly, Susan?
I think it's a tough sell for that. I agree. I think that, you know, people are not going to feel the pain the way that tolls are now. I mean, you just go through them. It's not the crash that happened in Connecticut. And believe it or not, you still hear that from people say, well, you know, it's going to be terrible. We're going to have another crash. I think but it is a tough sell for a lot of people because they feel that it's another tax.
Did you have one last thing, Dave?
I'm hearing from Tony Chirolis, the bicycle and transit advocate. He's saying that if you invest in mass transit, you help the economy, and that helps to solve both of our problems.
All right. Dan Haar, editor and columnist from Hearst Connecticut Media, and he really likes Fairfield County now. I like that we have this perspective. Susan Raff is here from WFSB. Colin McEnroe from the Colin McEnroe Show. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about legalized sports gambling. We'll talk about government shutdowns and clean up some other things from the week's news here on The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with Dan Haar, editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media, Susan Raff from WFSB, and Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show. I'm reading from an excellent column here in the Connecticut Post, Dan Haar. If you think Connecticut already depends too heavily on gambling between the two tribal casinos, the lottery, a robust off-track betting network, and an approved casino plan in East Windsor, wager this. The state will embrace legalized and lucrative sports betting this year. Oh boy, more gambling.
Well,
Dan?
Starting July 1st, they're going to have marijuana recreational sales in Massachusetts. We're probably going to have an additional 4 cent gas tax. We simply must give people a reason. Oh, and we're going to have in September the opening of MGM in Springfield. We simply must give people a reason to stay in Connecticut, right? Because they're going to just be going up there for the pot, the cheap gas, the gambling. Sports betting could be the answer here for us. Now, the first thing that has to happen is the Supreme Court has to rule. Nobody thinks, and no one I've talked with thinks anything other than that the Supreme Court is going to rule in favor of states, allowing states is going to overturn the 1992 ban on states sanctioning sports betting. Everybody thinks that because the conservatives like the hands-off approach and the liberals like taxes. And so everyone except for Justice Kennedy is going to vote for it. We're going to have it. And the idea for both the Speaker and the State Senate President, Marty Looney, is to have a bill ready to go. Shovel-ready bill in Connecticut. We pass it in March, and we have rules written by
June. Is this
June.
Your idea or their idea?
This is their idea.
Their idea, okay.
And what I'm saying is that that I don't think the scenario is going to play out exactly like that because as Senator, the other state Senate president, Len Fasano, points out, there are just too many problems we have to solve. Let's take our time about this, and that's more the Connecticut way.
I think the federal government wants to turn its back and let the states decide how they're going to raise money. I mean, look, marijuana is illegal. It's a class one drug. But here, you know, states are recreational marijuana, you know, one by one.
Tell that to Jeff Sessions.
I was going to say right. the Attorney General seems right. to have a slightly different view of that.
Right. But now, you know, sports betting, it's almost like they're saying, well, you know, you have to decide what you want is best.
Well, actually, it's good that Dan brought up marijuana in this conversation, Colin, because we've been saying this for years. People scream and say Connecticut should legalize and tax pot because other states are doing it because it's the right thing to do. We can raise money. And it's also the will of the people. You've often said that's the sort of thing maybe we should take a little slow and we should think about before we do it a certain way. I know that you've covered this a lot recently. Well, then there's sports betting. Let's just launch into it. Let's just have a shovel-ready bill because if it's going to be anywhere, we should do it right away. That seems to be two different messages, I think.
Well, what are the Eagles? 5.5? I think that bet. Eagles in the points? That's a good bet. Not reject that comparison, but I do think there's some modifications here. So, I mean, look, we know that there will be collateral damage if you add any kind of new form of gambling. There just is, right? And probably there might even be enough peer-reviewed studies so you could come up with a reasonable guess about what the collateral damage would be in terms of people getting addicted and spending down and hurting their families and all that kind of stuff. But we do have an awful lot of kinds of gambling right now. Most of them are, I think, probably more addictive, at least sort of in their neurological presentation. I'm thinking of Keno in particular. Than sports betting is. And we also, I think, as a society, are willing to live with a certain amount of collateral damage in order to get something like this. I do think marijuana needs to be I mean, I just feel like even a basic traffic stop, I don't know how that goes with legalized marijuana. You know, there's just so many aspects to that. I think it is a little bit different than sports betting. But that could be because I really would like to bet on the Eagles, and I don't at the moment know how to do that.
Go ahead, Dan.
If you're betting on the Eagles and the points, you might be using that thing that you want to study a little too much. But in any case, the problem with
my
the collateral
system?
The problem with the collateral damage in recreational marijuana, as they're seeing in Colorado and the other states, is that there's no test, right? You can't know if somebody's high. And so if it's legal, you're it's not like alcohol where there's a breath test and a blood test. You can't really know in pot, and that's a real problem.
Well, there is a test. Actually, it's a saliva test, and we did a story on it. It's about $4,000 a kid. And police in states are using this at a traffic stop, so they don't have to take you back to the police department. But it is expensive. You have to get training on it. And I'm not sure, you know, how many states are actually going to embrace it. But you're right. I mean, it's not as simple as whether someone has been drinking or not. But I think that the whole, like in states like California that have propositions that allow voters to decide on that, Connecticut is not set up for that. Some wish it was so that they could have a chance to weigh in on that.
I'll just say quickly that I'll show my covering New England bias, as I do for the New England News Collaborative. In Massachusetts and Maine, there were referendums to actually pass legalized pot. The legislatures in both of those states have slowed it down because they want to make sure that the tax regime actually makes sense and the state will be able to deal with all those unintended consequences and actually pay for things. State of Vermont, they didn't do it that way. They just passed it through the legislature, and they're not even taxing it, Colin. They're basically just saying, yeah, we know that people want to do it, and that's the Vermont way right now.
Right. Although, when you said you had a New England bias, I thought you were going to take the Patriots.
Never. The Steeler fan in me will never allow that to happen.
Because then I can make the bet right now.
Maybe.
With you. But no. So, not that Vermont is a radically different place than some of these places, but it, in some ways it doesn't necessarily. I think Vermont can absorb a change like that and maybe even fine-tune it as they go along. The problems that come up just based on what their population is and how spread out it is, it's something that they can maybe watch and go, oh, okay, we need to tweak this a little bit. Whereas if you drop a policy change like this in Connecticut or Massachusetts, I think you're going to see some problems that show up right away that you haven't figured out in advance, which you should.
Last word, Susan?
I think for Connecticut, though, the money aspect is hard to resist. A couple of years ago, they had some debates at the state capitol. They had a lawmaker come from Colorado who was talking about the millions of dollars in taxes that they've collected and all the schools that they've built. So I think
never legalize a drug just for the money. I think that's bad policy.
And that's the other side of the argument, too. Some say that's the wrong reason to do it.
Yeah.
But it is attractive.
Remember, Vermont doesn't have sales yet, so that's part of why they're not taxing it. They're not selling it.
Well, okay. Last couple of minutes here, Colin. I just want to quickly go. I mean, out of all of the dance that we did in Washington and the rest of the nation around the government shutdown, I mean, what's the big takeaway for you from the Democrats maybe caving into Donald Trump, certainly punting down the road this idea that we're going to have a closure of the government just a couple of weeks, and also maybe or maybe not some sort of deal for Dreamers?
First of all, the polling science on this indicates that government shutdowns, even worse government shutdowns than the one we just saw, don't matter in November. There's just no indication that they persist in public imagination enough to affect elections. And that was back in the good old days when they didn't happen simultaneously with Stormy Daniels and the president's cholesterol count and all kinds of other crazy stuff. So the notion that it's a political millstone one way or the other, I think, is false. I do think that what's happening nationally with the Democratic Party is it's getting younger and more liberal. I mean, I don't just think that. There's some polling science to support that, too. So they do want to see – we're back to the Bernie point we started out with. There's a lot of people in the party who do want to see pushback, who don't want to get rolled, and so who maybe aren't as fond of the kind of practical John Larson, Joe Courtney point of view of it's easier to fix the government when it's running than when it's not. They would like to see the hand get played out.
Yeah, and Connecticut senators stood on that side of it.
Yes, the entire delegation, except interestingly, Larson and Courtney, who is in the most Republican district, voted against the resolution. I think the Democrats nominally look like they may have lost, but in fact, they made the great point that we're willing to shut down the government for this issue. They are right on the moral side. They are right on the economic side, and that's going to hold the day.
I think the Democrats had to surrender temporarily because I think the public eye, the public people, they didn't want to see that happen, the government shutdown. But I'm interested to see if that fervor with DACA and the Dreamers will still be as passionate come February. It was the time to seize the moment then and not 2 months from now.
I have to end the show on sort of a down note, but I got to read this story because with all the things, as Colin just suggested, that are going on in the world, maybe this may have run past your screen and you didn't linger on the story. A Michigan man was arrested after allegedly threatening to shoot and kill CNN employees. And the FBI launched an investigation after the man, who is unnamed in this report, this was from The Hill, called CNN 22 times about a week ago. The quote is, "Fake news, I'm coming to gun you all down." So, Colin, I just have to say the reason this story is important is not because I'm in the media, and it's not because I have so many friends in the media, and it's not just because I support First Amendment rights and the freedom of the press so much, but it's because words really do matter. And we've seen this over and over again in America and actually in the rest of the world, that you can incite unstable people to do unstable and terrible things by just saying that somebody else is the enemy. And this averted tragedy at CNN might, I hope, be a wake-up call for us. I don't know that we're going to answer that call.
I don't think we're going to. And look, we all went through the campaign. There were, I mean, I think Susan and Danny and I all were at Trump rallies where Donald Trump would point out to the press and say, these are the worst people in the world. And all these, you know, hundreds of people around us would start booing us. And there were plenty of instances during the campaign where reporters were roughed up kind of as a result of that rhetoric. I mean, the guy who wound up winning the election encouraged people to have violent thoughts and negative thoughts about the press. And I just, you're going to see just more of this.
Well, Trump did it himself at several rallies. He would speak to the reporters and say, you know, this is great, I'm going to talk to you, and then turn around and say to the crowd, these are your enemies.
And we were stuck in a pen. It takes only one person to wreak havoc, not popular wisdom.
Mm. Right. Dan Haar from Hearst, Connecticut Media, Susan Raff from WFSB, Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show. Thanks so much to Betsy Kaplan, who helped out today, along with Kyle Wolf, our executive producers, Katie Talarski. This is The Wheelhouse. Thanks for joining us.